Thank you, Lee. I'd like to first welcome our guest musician here today, Fernando Ramses Peña Diaz. Ramses, hola. How about mucho gusto? Okay. Ramses, as he goes by, is a wonderfully versatile pianist. He's equally comfortable with classical, jazz, contemporary, traditional Mexican, and you'll hear a sample of most all of it this morning. Ramses is here because he's currently studying with my partner Malcolm Halliday. He's been working on some wonderful international competitions and some wonderful repertoire on that, and he's coaching on that here. He's also he's played several recitals, and there's one left if you were so inclined with what you hear today, you want to hear more. This afternoon at 3:00 at the First Congregational Church in Shrewsbury, there's a recital, and it's free, right? I think it's free because it's in memory of another pianist, and it's being sponsored. So if you'd like to hear more, 3:00 this afternoon is the place to do it in Shrewsbury. In each of us, there burns a sacred flame. And to begin our time together, to make this our sacred time, this our sacred place, we bring together a spark from the light that burns in each of us to light a common flame, reminding us that we are one, and together we bring a brighter light to the world, especially on this day when we reflect on the holiday of Yom Kippur. We're reminded that that light is not just a light of justice, but also one of love, compassion, and forgiveness. In ancient Hebrew times, when people would walk to their place of worship, they would do so singing simple songs as they traveled, and they would invite others to sing with them as they gathered. Words like Hava Nashira, Shira Alleluia, come, let us sing together, let us sing Alleluia. In our service today, our prayers are for forgiveness, for peace, for reconciliation. Osei Shalom. These words of meditation are by Mark Ballottini, entitled Ecole Nidre. Let's set it all down, you and me, the disappointments, little and large, the frustrations. Let's open our fists and drop them. The useless waiting, the obsession with what we cannot have, the focus on foolish things, the pinwheeling worry which wears us out, the fretting. Let's throw them down. The comparison of ourselves with others, the competition as if domination was the best name we could give to God, the cynical assumptions, the unspoken shelved anger. Let's toss them. The inarticulate suspicions, the self-doubt, the preemptive self-dumping, the numbing bouts of self-pity. Let's sink them like stones in the pool of this gift of silence. Let's drop them like hot rocks into the cool silence. Meditation is an opportunity to lift our eyes beyond the horizon, to travel inward to a sacred place beyond that horizon. I invite you to do that now, guided by this original composition by Ramses. Thank you. As Unitarian Universalists, I think we are very lucky in that we recognize the wisdom of not just our own tradition, but of many other faiths. Traditions that have come together to form us and those which we enrich our lives by learning about. For me, there are times when I feel a deep connection to some of those other faiths. At Christmas and Easter, the Christmas teachings of hope and renewal lift my spirits. At the change of the seasons, the earth-centered Native American teachings speak volumes to me. But this is the time of the year when I am drawn to Judaism. The progression through the high holy days that end the old and begin the new year provide us with a disciplined way of letting go of the old burdens and embracing the new life. It's not the same as those December 31st New Year's Eve parties with lots of booze and making these big resolutions that we're not even likely to remember a week or two later. No, during the Jewish holidays, we are called to truly take stock of our lives and then engage in a meaningful and rich practice that can help us to right those things that we have done that we should not have done, and also those things we have left undone that we should have done. It allows us also to let go and start anew, but only after we've done some repair work as well. It's not only a time when we seek forgiveness from others, but it's also when we forgive those who have wronged us, those we hold anger and resentment towards. It's not an easy process because the wrongs that pain us and the hurts that we have created in others, frankly, are often quite complex creatures. And at the very heart of this complexity is often a struggle we have with competing values. I think we need to recognize right up front that to truly engage in an observance of Yom Kippur, we need to address a fundamental theological question. It is a question that I have wrestled with all my life. And it is, what is more important, justice or forgiveness? Is fairness and righteousness the most important thing, or is it reconciliation? Who are we? Are we a justice-seeking people, or are we a mercy-granting people? In our Unitarian Universalist second principle, we state we affirm both justice and compassion in human relationships. We put it in the same principle. But the problem is that often they seem to be in conflict with each other. So where is the balance to be struck between those two conflicting moral imperatives? You know, we might pose this question at the level of great societal wrongs, horrible criminal acts against individuals or entire groups of people, or we can ask it at the level of very personal wrongs that are committed against us by those often with whom we are in close relationship. We might ask this question even from the other side, that being, in light of the wrongs that we have done to another person, what is it that we deserve? I think if we're honest, we will all acknowledge that we have all been perpetrators of wrongs on others, and I doubt any of us have made it this far in life without being the victim of some unfair or unjust treatment. How have we dealt with those situations in light of this tension between justice and forgiveness? Well, we're certainly not the first to have that challenge. And the central question is the one that's posed in the biblical story of Jonah and the Ninevites. And usually when we have our children with us, children and youth often act out a version of that biblical story to kind of get the message to us. But they have different programming this morning and aren't with us. So I want to just remind you of some key points in that story. You remember that Jonah, who was a northern Israel farmer, was told by the voice of God to go to Nineveh to tell the very wicked people there, who were the enemies of the Israelites, that they had 40 days to repent and change their ways or they were going to be destroyed. Jonah wants no part of this mission. In his mind, God should just destroy them now, do the justice, if you will. So Jonah decides to escape somewhere far where God can't find him. So he gets on a boat heading for the far-off city of Tarshish. And you'll remember what happens after that. A terrible storm comes up and threatens to drown everyone on the boat. The crew decides that Jonah has brought this upon them. And finally, they decide the only way to get the storm to cease and to save their lives is to throw him overboard. They do. It works. And Jonah ends up in the belly of a whale. That's the part of the story the kids always like the best. But it's really the next part of the story that has the real moral teaching for us. The whale spits out Jonah. God's voice is heard again, and reluctantly, Jonah decides he better go to Nineveh. He does, and he sees the evil there. He warns the people, unless they change their ways and seek God's forgiveness, they'll be destroyed. That's what he expects to happen. But much to his surprise, they do change, and God forgives them. But Jonah isn't happy. Jonah is protesting in this story what he sees is a real lack of justice. He holds on to his anger, and it eats at him. He's miserable, but he just can't bring himself to forgive those people. I thought about this story and the approaching holiday of Yom Kippur last week as I watched the news from Colombia, which I'm sure many of you did too. The government and the rebel group known as the FARC, after years of negotiation, I think 8 years, had reached a proposed peace agreement. The issue that made this negotiation so long was the very same issue with which Jonah wrestled. That issue of justice. During this 50-year war, more than 200,000 people had died and millions were driven from their homes by the FARC. What kind of price would these guerrillas pay for their actions? Well, in the peace agreement that was proposed, the FARC members would give up their arms. They were required to confess all their horrible acts in a sort of truth and reconciliation type tribunal. There were to be some restrictions on them for a period of time, but no long jail terms or real severe punishments. It seemed like an amazing opportunity for peace after 50 years of war and suffering, but it had to be ratified by popular vote to go into effect. And what happened? By a very small margin, the people of Colombia rejected the peace deal that was negotiated over all that time. And when you listen to the interviews with those who voted against it, they sound a lot like Jonah. The FARC had done horrible things, and the agreement did not call for enough justice, was the basic message, even though their lives would undoubtedly be improved with this deal in effect. Those who voted against the deal could not let go of their pain and anger. Letting go of hate and anger and pain and reconciled with those who have hurt you is no easy process. Not easy at the level of countries and governments, and not easy at the level of personal pain and anger either. You know, justice and mercy are key religious values, and the Jews are not alone in struggling to reconcile them. Islam and Christianity also counsel us to both demand justice and also to turn the other cheek and forgive. The prophets all demand justice for the poor and the oppressed and for those who have been wronged. But when Jesus was asked by Peter, should he forgive someone who wronged him as many as 7 times? Jesus says, no, you should forgive him 70 times 7 times. Why? It can be a very confusing moral dilemma. think on the one hand, forgiveness too easily given can fail to fully recognize the harm the perpetrator has committed. When there's little or no justice and only forgiveness, there's probably no deterrence from future bad acts, no reason why the perpetrator, or maybe even others who follow his example, won't continue to do the same thing. If there are no real consequences, we may operate in a way that says it's more expedient just to do the deed and, if caught, ask for forgiveness later. If forgiveness is cheap and easy, it strikes me that we can even do real damage. I think of the often trapped domestic abuse victim who forgives the perpetrator again and again. We know that this forgiving behavior can empower that perpetrator to continue to commit abuse. Forgiveness without some aspect of justice isn't the answer either. You know, I really do understand why Jonah wants more, why the people in Colombia want more. Those who have been wronged really often see justice only in terms of the most severe punishment that can be given. For someone who's been severely hurt, often there can never be enough justice. When I was an assistant DA, and I've referred to this job of mine many times, but one of the things that I regularly did was handle sentence reduction hearings, people who'd been incarcerated for a long time and were bringing a petition based on good behavior to see if their sentence could be reduced. And the victims of the crimes were always called in. And one of the most profound things I found in many of those cases were 8 or 10 years after a crime was committed, some of those victims were in the same place that they'd been right after the crime was committed, with almost the same degree of anger. And I have to say, I wondered to myself in those situations, who really was the prisoner here? It's not unreasonable at all that we should expect that those who do wrong to us should pay some price. You know, that's the position that Jonah was arguing with God. Those Ninevites didn't deserve forgiveness. Jonah's own people had been punished by God for far less egregious offenses, and the Ninevites were their enemies. He wanted them destroyed. He conveyed that judgment to them, and he anxiously awaited it. But the unexpected happened. They sought that forgiveness, and they turned in a different direction. But it really, in Jonah's mind, didn't matter. The wrong had been done, and not to retaliate, he would see as an extreme lack of justice. He's so angry about the injustice of the situation, he wants to see it, the ultimate price paid, just like many of those people in Colombia do. You know, in Jonah's desire for justice, in his inability to make room for forgiveness, you remember in the story, he is miserable. The anger he feels consumes him. He simply cannot let it go. He becomes paralyzed by his anger, to the point he's so depressed, he feels his life is not worth living. C.S. Lewis once described that kind of anger that Jonah was experiencing by using the words delicious anger. He wrote that holding on to that pain was like feasting on a great roast. But when you were done picking all the meat off the bones, my apologies to vegetarians, you discovered that the carcass you devoured was in fact your own. Have you ever come to that conclusion? To the realization that the anger you were harboring, you had towards someone else, perhaps perfectly justified from a justice standpoint, was nonetheless consuming you? It was holding you stuck in a place where you were kind of devouring yourself. Perhaps for some who really suffered terrible wrongs, even to the point where you have nothing but anger to live for. To some extent, most of us know what a negative force this kind of anger can be in our lives. If you're in that place or have been in that place, hear these words of Desmond Tutu. Know what was done to you was wrong, unfair and undeserved. You are right to be outraged, and it's perfectly normal to want to hurt back when you've been hurt. But hurting back rarely satisfies. Until we can forgive, we remain locked in our pain and locked out of the possibility of experiencing healing and freedom, locked out of the possibility of being at peace. Without forgiveness, we remain tethered to the person who harmed us. We are bound with chains of bitterness, tied together, trapped. Until we can forgive the person who harmed us, that person will hold the keys to our happiness. That person will be our jailer. When we forgive, we take back control of our own fate and feelings. We become our own liberators. We don't forgive to help the other person. We don't forgive for others. We forgive for ourselves. Well, how do you do that? Well, first, if you are the victim, there's got to be some transition time when we temper our anger, when we move beyond our hurt. If you're the perpetrator, there must be a time when you try to make things right, when you seek forgiveness. And then you let go of your own guilt and forgive yourself. We need to be able to forgive each other and ourselves so that we can move ahead with our lives as the loving individual that we are all capable of being. I think that's really why Yom Kippur is celebrated, to formally recognize that we must make this transition if we are to move on with our lives. You know, it's no coincidence that Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah come together on the calendar. One involves the act of seeking and granting forgiveness for past wrongs, and the other starts a new phase of life, a new year. The proximity in time, I think, demonstrates how interdependent they are. In a nutshell, to move forward, you must be reconciled with the past. For some who've suffered pain and abuse, the rejection of divorce, the hate of racism, of homophobia, of anti-Semitism, or the horror of being the victims of a violent crime, becoming sufficiently reconciled with the past so we can move ahead is not easy or quick. To move from anger and pain to forgiveness and reconciliation requires us to engage in a discipline, in a practice. The wisdom of a holiday like Yom Kippur is that it is an invitation to engage in the discipline of working towards forgiveness. The practice is called teshuvah. And to perform teshuvah correctly, the perpetrator, where possible, must make restitution and vow to change and not repeat the wrongful action. The word teshuvah literally means turning. And as the reading we shared this morning expressed, this is our time of turning. This autumn turning comes naturally for those leaves and those trees and the birds that are heading south, but not so easily for us. But aren't those trees beautiful reminders of how we need to turn? It takes a great act of will to let go of anger, to admit we've been wrong, to forgive. Forgiveness is the practice of turning from retribution to reconciliation, from anger back to the ability to love. Real forgiveness is not primarily about mending the past, but really about making the future possible. Within each of us, there is the desire for justice and the need to forgive and the need to be forgiven. Within our society, there is a need to see that justice happens, of course, while at the same time, there is a need to allow space for reconciliation. We live our lives in the tension of those forces. The teachings of this holiday of Yom Kippur guides us in a way that we might balance them. The practice of teshuvah, or turning, is the way we can work through the wrongs we have done to others, others have done to us, and even through the wrongs of our world. After participating in the prayers of Yom Kippur, a young child asked his rabbi, "Does God pray?" And the rabbi said, "Yes." And the child then asked, "Well, then, what does God pray for on Yom Kippur?" And the rabbi said, "God prays these words: may my capacity for mercy be greater than my capacity for justice." That's the message that Jonah couldn't accept. And the question is, how about all of us? In our difficult relationships, maybe with parents or children, or spouses, in our fractured families or in failed marriages, in neighbors we can't get along with, in all the places where we've been hurt by things like hate or homophobia or sexism or racism or any other ism, will we allow our capacity for mercy to exceed our need for justice? And likewise, will we work to repair what we have broken, to restore trust, to earn forgiveness from others? Can we turn anger to forgiveness? Can we temper our justice with kindness and replace our anger with mercy? That's what Yom Kippur asks of us. In ways large and small, in new situations and old ones, I tell you that I still have not been able to completely reconcile everything in my life. But Yom Kippur is a challenge for me every year. I know it's work that I need to do every year. And though I always fall short, each year I make some progress and I feel some sense of liberation. And the older I get, the more I see the wisdom of this Jewish holiday. And even though it can be tough, I welcome the annual invitation to really engage in this practice. I hope you will engage in a forgiveness practice in this season of turning. And I hope this year your capacity for mercy will be greater than your capacity for justice.